everyone, and welcome to Popcorn Science. In this podcast, we take a critical look at the science portrayed in our favorite movies and television shows. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Catherine Niche. I'm a professor of earth sciences, a planetary geologist, and a fan of pop culture.
And I'm Dr. John Moores, a professor of space engineering at York University, a planetary atmospheric scientist, and just a great big speculative fiction nerd. This week was my choice, and I've picked a short one, but a really memorable one, at least for me. I've picked the film Gravity. So let me go ahead and give you a little synopsis of this particular movie. So Gravity tells the story of an astronaut thrown into a terrifying situation known as the Kessler syndrome. And don't worry, you'll hear more about that when we get into the discussion as to what that is. What happens in the movie is we've got a missile test on a satellite, and this goes awry when the shrapnel from the first satellite that was hit by the missile strikes another and another, creating a chain reaction that eventually destroys the astronaut's shuttle, the International Space Station, and just about everything in low Earth orbit.
Explorer, this is Houston.
Go ahead, Houston.
NORAD reports a Russian satellite has incurred a missile strike. The impact has created a cloud of debris orbiting at 20,000 miles per hour. Current debris orbit does not overlap with your trajectory. We'll keep you posted on any developments.
Copy that, Houston.
Should we be worried?
Well, let's let the boys down there worry for us.
So the astronaut's name is Ryan. They're played by Sandra Bullock. And they've got to stay one step ahead of the demolition using nothing but her training and her ingenuity as she tries to get back to the surface of our planet alive. But gravity and orbital mechanics are unforgiving masters in one of the most intense films we've ever reviewed, and I think that I've ever seen, really. So I think you've got an interesting history with this movie, Catherine. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I was glad that you brought this one up because I had totally forgotten about it. But it was actually, I was really excited to see it when it came out, so much so that I actually left my baby daughter at home for the first time to go see it in an IMAX theater on Merritt Island. So at the time, I worked at the Florida Institute of Technology in Melbourne, Florida. So that's just south of Kennedy Space Center. And we went up to Merritt Island, which is actually where Kennedy Space Center is, just 14 miles south of there, because there was a big IMAX theater there, and I wanted to see Gravity in IMAX, which honestly is the best and correct way to see this movie. Yeah, so I like I said, I'd forgotten I'd seen it, but when John brought it up, I was like, oh yeah, that was such an important movie to me, and yet somehow I've forgotten it these 13 years later.
It does leave quite an impact, I have to say. So I don't know that I saw it when it was in theaters. And you're right, I think IMAX would be the way to do it, to just have that sense of overwhelm and being surrounded by the action. It's such an economical film, I think. It's one where there doesn't seem to be a wasted shot or a wasted scene, and the tension just keeps ratcheting up. I challenge you, dear viewer, to try and watch it in more than one sitting. You keep going, and then it's, you know, in less than 90 minutes, it's over.
It does keep you on the edge of your seat. I do remember thinking throughout the movie, like, is she going to make it? Everything was just going wrong.
Yeah.
It's very stressful. it's easier to watch it when you know, spoiler alert, she does actually survive. That kind of takes some of the tension away. But it was, yeah, it was an intense movie to watch for the first time there.
I actually watched it this time, the rewatch I did with my wife, and yeah, it was a lot for her, you know, in terms of the stress. I mean, I did let her know that Sandra Bullock does live, you know.
I also had to assure my son that she was going to survive. He kept poking his head around. I'm like, this movie's too scary for you. And his head just kept popping out. He's trying to watch it. It is very plot light, I would say. I think it focuses more on the action than the plot, but somehow I'm not bothered by that either because the action is so well done.
That is fascinating, right? Because you go into a lot of movies these days and they have these action set pieces and I'm like, you know what? I don't really need this. Like, I know the spectacle and whatnot, but it's like, okay, do we need another shot of people speeding through another canyon?
Right. Another car chase.
It, right? Exactly.
But when the car chase is in space, it's more exciting.
Oh, yeah. Like, there's something almost operatic about this one, which we'll get into. And I have to say, my recollection was of this was that it was amazingly accurate. And so it's been, I think, good to watch in this context of putting this podcast together and having this conversation with Catherine first, you know, online, as we do every week, dear listener. And then the conversation we have here, because there are some things I think that were below my notice, but, you know, you've always been a little bit closer, I feel, to the human spaceflight side of things than I have, or at least more aware of it.
Yeah, I honestly don't remember what I thought about this movie when I first watched it, other than it was kind of this intense roller coaster. So I wasn't thinking about the accuracy. We'll talk about what I feel about that now, 13 years later, but nothing stood out to me. It's not like the core or anything where you leave the movie, you know, laughing at the absurdity of it. So it must have been good enough to pass for me at the time.
As you may expect, any time we take a close look at something, we're going to find things to talk about. So let's just go ahead and get right into the science gripes. So what was the thing that really stood out to you that bothered you, Catherine?
Well, the thing you see most talked about online, and I honestly don't know if it bothers me or not, but I think it's definitely something to be talked about, is the scene where George Clooney dies. So
Yes.
So George Clooney and Sandra Bullock, and I'm going to forget their character names probably throughout this podcast, are the two surviving members of this catastrophic event that destroys their space shuttle, the fictitiously named Explorer space shuttle, which never actually existed. And they have to try to make their way over to the International Space Station in order to get back to Earth and survive. But there's this scene. So he's got this, it's called a man maneuvering unit, little jetpack basically to let him fly around, which we see him doing around the space shuttle before all hell breaks loose. And so they're jetting over to the International Space Station. And for some reason, they keep coming at every object in space at like huge relative velocities. They just start slamming into things. I don't know why they do that. I mean, they didn't try to modulate their velocity to come up on it on a little bit slower velocity. But anywho, they jet their way over to the International Space Station, and they're just smacking into the side of it, trying to get a handhold, which is also pretty ridiculous. But at one point, Sandra Bullock gets her leg caught in the parachute of the Soyuz module, which is attached to the side of the space station. And she managed to grab George Clooney. And now, the creators of this movie have an explanation for this, but to my mind, it looked like she had halted his motion, and they were just sitting there with no velocity, and yet he decides, for plot reasons, I guess, that he wants to die and lets go. And somehow, even though it looked like he had stopped moving, floats away from her, which is something that would happen if you were on Earth and there was gravity acting on you. Like if you're dangling from a cliff, right, you let go, he's going to drop. But they're in space, and it did not look like he was moving. And so it was really odd to see him then let go and float away. They tried to explain this by saying, oh, she's actually still being pulled out of the space station, and he didn't think that the parachute would hold them both, and so that's why he lets go. But honestly, it seems pretty ridiculous watching it, and it really just seemed like a plot device.
Yeah, like it's one of these things where the relative velocity seems low, right? So even if he's going to float away, he's not going to float away that fast. And yet he's out of radio communication quite quickly.
Right, right.
As opposed to the start, right, where she's whipping around and she gets that slingshot effect when she gets off of the, you know, the Canadarm, without the flag, of course. But she gets whipped off of that thing and he has no trouble going and retrieving her.
Well, no, and they're even not able to talk for a little while there. And then he gets close enough and I think they can talk. So maybe these radios have very limited range. I don't know. But it definitely looked like she could have just like tugged on him a little bit and he would have gone back towards the International Space Station slowly at this time, not going at 100 miles an hour, slamming into the side. So whatever they intended, what came out on screen looked pretty unbelievable.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. And the other thing that I've seen that people have complained about online, and now we're moving over to sort of like the Neil deGrasse Tysons and the Phil Plates of the world, is just thinking about the different orbital inclinations.
Yeah, that was the next thing I was going to bring up. That's the other pretty unbelievable thing. Go ahead, John.
Oh, yeah. Like it's really interesting because they move from spacecraft to spacecraft in the course of the destruction. They start out on the shuttle, then they go to the International Space Station, and then they head over to the Chinese Space Station. And these things are not really near to one another. In fact, they're not even on the same orbital planes, right? The different inclinations of that that orbit. And I think Catherine had a really good analogy here. It's like you're going along, you know, even if you're going very, very fast on the highway, you could, in theory, get from one ship to another and one car to another fairly easily. But if the highways are intersecting one another, it's very difficult to jump from one car to the other car. Don't try this at home, folks. And on orbit, it's even worse. Like the amount of energy you would need, the size of the rocket you would need to make that maneuver is actually pretty darn enormous, because you don't even have the benefit of the friction of the wheels with the ground in order to make a turn. So there were definitely some problems, I think, with speed in this one, right? Not just the inclinations and getting between them, changing your altitude, because of course they start up very high for astronauts at 600 kilometers because they're servicing the Hubble Space Telescope. Then they got to get down to the ISS at 400. But they also have these interesting intersections every 90 minutes with the debris field. And if that stuff's really in a different orbital inclination, in a different orbit, it's going to be coming at kilometers per second. And you can't even see that. It's like trying to track bullets. But yet you can see things streaking by. So there was some relative motion issues, I think, here.
Yeah, Sandra Bullock's in the wrong movie, right? If we're having problems with speed. Ba-dum-chink.
Yes, yes. She's way over 50 miles an hour the whole time, which yeah. must be why it's completely crazy.
But yeah, so to put this in perspective, so like John says, they're servicing the Hubble Space Telescope, which orbits the Earth at around 600 kilometers altitude. But the International Space Station and the Chinese space station, Tiangong, orbit closer to about 400 kilometers. So that's a difference, about 200 kilometers in altitude. And that means they're orbiting at vastly different speeds. The difference is something like 250 miles per hour. So how the heck would you get from one orbit to another unless you had, you know, one of Clooney's, what was it, a 69 Corvette or something?
The 67 Corvette.
Oh, 67 yeah. Corvette. Yeah.
The 74 GTO would not get you there.
Sadly, he did not have that. He just had a jetpack. And the manned maneuvering unit, the MMU, that the shuttle astronauts actually used in the 80s could only go about 25 meters per second. So it's nowhere near to the oomph you would need to get from one orbit to another. So the fact that they show them so close together and they're so easily able to maneuver from one space station to a shuttle to another space station is just pretty unbelievable.
Oh yeah, and the differences between some of these things are not necessarily speeding up, or like orbital mechanics is non-intuitive too, and yet everything they go to on orbit, they just thrust towards it.
Yes, yes, they're not trying to change their altitude obviously or their positioning. So yeah, there's no way they could have gone from one station to the next. It's just highly unbelievable. But it looked cool. And it would be fun.
Oh, 100%.
If there was just like all these buddies in space, you know, you could take a little trip over to the ISS and hang out with your friends after a long day servicing the Hubble Space Telescope.
It is interesting, right? Because even while the movie is happening, you get the sense that the things that are happening are just so crazy improbable, right? Sandra Bullock's character is just getting insanely lucky at each point, even if the maneuvers were possible.
Or insanely unlucky, right? That this all happened to begin with. I mean, that's the other thing. Like, the chances that the satellite debris would be in the same orbit as them is also extremely low, right? And the fact that it hits them at the Hubble 600 kilometer altitude, but also the ISS 400 kilometer altitude. Like, where is this debris coming from? That doesn't make a whole lot of sense that they would even intersect with it at all.
Oh yeah. And the repetition of 90 minutes. I mean, I'm almost certain that that comes from the fact that if you're at an orbit of about 400 kilometers, you have a 90 minute period.
For sure.
But it's not like this cloud of debris is stationary and they're just coming and going through it every 90 minutes.
Yeah, so, it's also orbiting the Earth. Yeah,
exactly. So the intersection points are going to be a little bit different. But I do enjoy that they got their information from somewhere. It's truthy if it's not the truth.
Truthy, yeah, yeah. That's a good word for it. I agree. I appreciated the 90-minute repetition because I was like, oh, I know that. That's how fast the space station orbits.
Exactly.
The astronauts themselves were, I also found, a little bit unbelievable. So Sandra Bullock, in talking to George Clooney, states that, you know, she was only brought onto this mission to install a particular imaging system. She normally works in a hospital. Again, I'm not sure why they're asking a hospital worker to install an imaging system on a telescope. That needed more explanation for me. And then she becomes an astronaut in only 6 months, which is way too short. Most astronauts take years to do this sort of training. Basic training is 2 years. And then if you're going to do a spacewalk, that's like additional years you have to do. There is no way they would put someone like her out on a spacewalk with 6 months of training.
And Clooney and Bullock, their characters don't seem to know each other very well, as if they've barely trained together. Like, it's almost like this is a work site and this is Sandra Bullock's first day.
Right.
It feels like that.
It does. It does. Yeah. I mean, even 6 months, he would presumably know like where she lived and if she was married and not be asking her all these basic questions, unless he's an extreme narcissist, which, you know, maybe. But most astronauts I've met are not that way. So again, George Clooney is not a very realistic astronaut either. So it was hard to take them seriously.
Yeah, it's interesting because I remember you looked out and you saw some comments from actual astronauts.
Yes.
About this movie. And it seems like they were more bothered by it. I mean, that's always true. I mean, we take on stuff here, which is in our area of expertise, and it always irks us, the little things. But yeah, Chris was not a fan.
Yeah, so I found a quote from former astronaut Chris Hadfield, hopefully a fan of the pod, since, as I mentioned earlier, I did spend a summer living with him and his family in 1999. But his quote was that he was critical of the portrayal of Bullock's character, saying, "When she's faced with a problem, she's panicking and has no idea what to do. George Clooney is driving around like some sort of space cowboy, and he's the only one who has any idea what's going on. I think it set back a little girl's vision of what a woman astronaut can be for an entire generation." And I kind of see what he's saying. She's freaking out. She's bumbling a lot of the tasks. She needs this man to save her. It's just she doesn't fit the profile of most astronauts I've encountered. Most of them are extremely calm. They just go through the motions. They're not going to freak out. They've done this so many times before. They're just going through the steps. And yeah, inside they might be nervous, but they don't let on, and they're very well trained to do their jobs.
And I mean, that's a lot of what this time spent down on the ground is all about, right? It's about drilling. It's about developing that kind of almost first responder mindset, where when a bad thing happens or there's an emergency, you go to your training, you drill so that you don't have to think.
Yes.
But this particular movie is, I think, really interesting because just the sequence of events and the improbabilities would drive anybody out of their comfort zone and out of their knowledge. And I do wonder what would happen to somebody in that case. Like, by the time we get to the Chinese space station, Sandra Bullock's character is just pushing buttons, right? There's no idea anymore.
Eeny, meeny, miny, mo.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I was surprised it worked at all, right? There's so many buttons.
Which is almost too bad, right? Because if it is based on the Soyuz, you'd think that she'd have some educated guesses.
Well, I think that's where the eeny, meeny, miny, mo came from. I think she had some idea of roughly where she was supposed to hit. But not enough to read Chinese letters.
So we'd done Chris Hadfield's quote. Did you want to talk about, yeah, you know, whether Sandra Bullock is a good role model?
So I can see Hadfield's point about her not being a great role model, right? She comes across as a woman in distress, almost, like, who needs to be saved. And in the end, she does save herself. But, like, she also needs the ghost of a man to help her through the last little bit. So I do wonder, it would have been fun if they reversed the roles, right? If Ryan Stone had actually been a man and George Clooney had been a woman telling the man what to do, that would have been a more interesting story, I think. Showing the woman as the more capable one, the one willing to sacrifice themselves and not the damsel in distress.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to think about it a little bit, because neither character is a great example of an astronaut, right? But it points to the idea that it's not just representation now, right? You want to actually see people able to be assertive, take charge, you know, display their knowledge, right? And you don't want to have a repeat of one of our favorite characters from the Corps, who was also portrayed a little bit as somebody who might have been advanced too quickly and didn't know what they were doing, even though they were a space shuttle pilot and later a pilot of some other craft.
Yeah. Anyways, so I mean, this was. We'll talk about this in of its time. This movie is 13 years old, but even then, like, this is not how astronauts should have been portrayed. I was at an event talking to the Artemis astronauts a few weeks ago in Ottawa, which was amazing. They're really cool people. It was really neat to hear their stories. And even though they seemed so calm and cool and collected throughout the course of that mission, they did talk a lot about how nervous they were during the reentry. You'd never know it though. Like when I heard the commander Reed Wiseman's voice upon reestablishing connection with mission control, he seemed totally calm. Like I did not notice any nerves in his voice, but they had concerns. It's just, they're so drilled into doing it a certain way. It just, you don't see that from them. The other thing that I thought was somewhat unrealistic for the astronauts was that they had Ryan Stone go out on a spacewalk when she was clearly nauseous. So first of all, she probably wouldn't have been nauseous. This is a very common ailment in space. We talked about it, I think, in our second show, Ender's Game, how I think it wasn't Ender, right? It was some other kid who, like, you know, lost his cookies on the space flight up to the school. This is very common to feel ill in space. Your inner ear is just totally out of whack, doesn't know how to interpret things, and you become nauseous as a result. So much so that astronauts typically take anti-nausea pills before they even go up to kind of get rid of that. And you keep taking those, and you get used to outer space, and they don't actually do spacewalks until the fourth day of flight to get rid of these issues. If you were still feeling ill, they would never send you out on a spacewalk, though, because the chances of you bringing up your lunch, shall we say, and it coating the interior of your helmet are quite high, and that can be quite problematic because you'll be blinded, and that's not great when you're in space. So this actually happened during Apollo 9. They almost canceled one of the EVAs, the extravehicular activities, because the astronaut was experiencing nausea and vomiting the day before, and they didn't want him to get into trouble by throwing up in his helmet.
So I think another part of this that bothered me a little bit was the communications section. So a big part of this, the astronauts are out of comms very quickly. And it seems to be that you've got something, we'll probably talk about the Kessler syndrome more in the Science Shine, but you've got this cloud of debris that's taking out everything, including the satellites that that mission control uses to communicate with the astronauts. And that might have been true in the 1960s. There was a system in place to provide comms to folks on orbit in the 60s in low Earth orbit called STADAN. What's happened over time is that that's changed. Most of the satellite communications that even we experience in the civil realm occur through geostationary satellites. And NASA made that move as well in the early 1980s. So they created a system called TDRSS, which is intended to provide seamless communications to astronauts no matter where they are in their orbit. And that's way up at 36,000 kilometers. So much, much higher than the kinds of orbits we're talking about here. Unlikely that those would be affected. The only way I can think that the situation works the way that it's described in the movie, and I don't know the answer to this, but it could be that the suit radios aren't capable of reaching those satellites, and that we've destroyed whatever repeaters are on the shuttle and the space stations and whatnot. Yet they do make quite a habit of talking to themselves, of making these sort of diary entries. And I don't know if that does anything, whether there's a recorder on the spacesuit to take that. Yeah.
Yeah. Or I think it's called, they keep saying Houston in the blind, right? I think they're hoping they're receiving it, but they're just not able to talk to them. That's my guess. But yeah, this really bothered me too. Like they can't talk to anybody on Earth. She ends up talking to an Inuit fisherman in Greenland, but she can't talk to Houston. It just beggared belief that that would happen. And even the scene where she is talking to the fisherman, which was a very touching scene, there's actually a short film, it's only 7 minutes long, where you actually see the Inuit's point of view in Greenland, which is pretty fun. If you can find a copy of it, it's not easy to find. it's kind of cool to see the other side. It also translates what he's saying, so you can get an idea for what he's talking about, since they don't actually bother to translate it from the other side, which I think is fine, because, right, she's not going to understand what he's saying. So it shows it more from her perspective. But I looked it up, and it's also extremely unlikely that she would have been able to talk to anybody in Greenland. So I think at the time, she's, I think, very close to the International Space Station. So I'm going to assume she's basically on the same orbit as the International Space Station. But that only goes up as high as, oh, let me look it up. Here it is. The highest latitude for the ISS is about 52 degrees north. in Aningak, the Inuit fisherman, was at about 69 degrees north. So in the short film, he says what fjord he's in. So I looked it up. But most of Greenland is above 52 degrees north. I think all of Greenland is above 52 degrees north. So it's really improbable that you'd be able to talk to somebody with a difference of almost 20 degrees latitude. I would say it's impossible. It's just not going to happen. The other thing is, like, the chances that they're on the same frequency are really low. I was talking to my husband about this, who's a ham radio nerd, and he was going deep into the weeds on this. We were trying to, like, figure out what frequency it was. And our best guess is it's either a 6 meter wavelength or 50 megahertz, or possibly a 2 meter wavelength, 144 megahertz. Those are very common ham radio frequencies. And we were kind of looking at the size of the antenna on his, it's a sled, I think, that he has it on.
Of course, of course.
Because, you know, he's up in Greenland. And so the latitudes are wrong. The frequencies are probably wrong. The Soyuz uses 122 megahertz transmitter. So the chances they could talk are just, like, astronomically low, bordering on impossible. And so it's strange that the one person they have her talking to is somebody she wouldn't have even been able to have talked to. It's a very sweet scene, but not very realistic.
Such a shame that that's not on YouTube. And even though you get up quite a bit higher with the ISS and you can see quite a ways. You can see almost 10 degrees in terms of latitude. It doesn't quite get you where it needs to be here. So there's one more thing that I want to talk about. And if there's another thing, feel free to bring it up, Catherine. But her interaction with airlocks, you highlighted this. And I think we each had separate problems with this. Like, I think you had a problem with the opening and I had a problem with the physical result of that. But you go ahead first.
So there's a couple of scenes where she's, like, trying to get into a space station and she opens the airlock. Basically, the whole thing just blows out because there's air in the station and blows her out with it. And she's, like, barely hanging on and then has to climb in. But I looked it up and most airlocks actually push inward, not outward. So if there is atmosphere in there, which there would have been because there was nobody else inside to evacuate the atmosphere in the airlock, she wouldn't have been able to push it in. She probably wouldn't have been able to get in at all because there was no way for her to vent the air. So anyways, so that it's a cool scene, but not very realistic. What was your issue with the airlocks, John?
Well, it was so slapstick, right? And so she's really getting thrown around. And
point,
you know, she's stressed out. She's panicky. She's really, really low on oxygen. They make a big, you know, deal about being low on oxygen here. And I'm like, she just got her whole body slammed back into the space station. How is she holding on in this case? And later on when she takes off the spacesuit, which of course, you know, she doesn't have any of the cooling systems or any of the typical undergarments that are worn by astronauts to manage heat. She's not bruised up. She's not dealing with any kind of, you know, broken bones and whatnot. I understand, you know, this is a fictional environment and they often gloss over these sorts of things. But still, like, it's just, she's taken a lot of punishment out there.
Yeah, it really struck me when she, takes her spacesuit off by herself, which the filmmakers acknowledge this is impossible, but they had to do it for the purposes of this film. And then she just had underpants on underneath. I was like, wait a minute. Typically, there's this cooling garment that they wear. Apparently, they also wear diapers because, again, they're outside for, like, hours, right? Socks. Just, she would have been, like, freezing to death if she was just in her underwear. So even I, with limited knowledge of human spaceflight, called that out. It was a cool scene, as we'll talk about, very reminiscent of other movies, but not terribly realistic. I was also surprised to see that she just, like, fit into somebody else's Soyuz spacesuit, right? The chances of that are pretty low. You'd have to be almost, like, the exact same shape and height, I think, to share a spacesuit
and
like that.
And fortunately, that last sip of oxygen, because she seems to be at, like, no oxygen for an awfully long time.
Right.
It's simply because George Clooney and Sandra Bullock haven't really done the proper astronaut training. So they're unaware that these types of suits typically have a secondary O2 system that lasts for a half hour. You can actually breathe air in the void space in the suit. And there's actually a fair bit in there. I took a look into this and it looks like you typically get something like 70 liters or so of void space in these suits. They really are inflated like a balloon, which will give you a few minutes, but maybe not as much as is shown in the movie. So I don't know if this is shine or gripe, but it's definitely somewhere in the area.
It didn't bother me so much, right? Like, she was sucking back oxygen really quickly. So that's realistic. As someone who has gone scuba diving, the more panicked you are, the faster you breathe, and the more quickly you use up your oxygen. And you know, although she did run out of oxygen, like you said, she would have had more minutes left just breathing the stuff in her suit. So I didn't bother me so much. The only thing that bothered me is, like, she's clearly running out of air. She's starting to hallucinate or black out with all the CO2. And she's just having this long conversation with George Clooney rather than, like, actively trying to get to the airlock. I was like, come on, move it. You know, I didn't love that part.
It's true. And we do know later on that she hallucinates really fast when she gets hypoxic.
It's true. It's true.
So maybe at this point, we'll put a pin in this and we'll be right back in a couple minutes with the Science Shine. So we found lots of stuff to talk about, I think, in terms of the science gripes. But there are things about this that we liked. In fact, there's a lot about it that we liked. So, Catherine, was there something that really shone through for you?
Well, the whole premise of the movie, this whole missile strike that destroys a satellite and causes this chain reaction, when they mentioned that, my ears perked up because I remember there was a lot of discussion about 20 years ago about a very similar test that China conducted, which created a whole ton of debris in low Earth orbit that's still a problem to this day. So this happens. People were not very happy about it, and they still aren't. And I think they do try to avoid this. But in 2007, China conducted what's known as an anti-satellite missile test. Basically, they were trying to see if they could shoot down their own satellite, which they did. In this case, it was a weather satellite. Had an altitude of about 860 kilometers. And they sent up something called a kinetic kill vehicle, which is just something that destroys something else because it's going really fast. And it caused so much shrapnel up at this really high altitude. So if you're at a low altitude, it's not a big deal because that debris will burn up in the atmosphere pretty shortly. But at an altitude of 860 kilometers, it's going to take months or years for that stuff to decay back to Earth. In the meantime, it's causing a lot of trouble for things in low Earth orbit. Let's see, as of today, 3,000 of the 10,000 pieces of space debris tracked by the U.S. military as a threat to the International Space Station originated from this 2007 shootdown. So that's like a third of the stuff that's threatening the ISS came from this one missile test. And in 2011, one of the debris from this test passed within 6 kilometers of the ISS. So it is a problem for spaceflight. And it doesn't have to be large debris, like something the size of a fleck of paint can act like a bullet at the speeds we're talking about. So this definitely happens. It's definitely a concern for orbiting shuttles and spacecraft.
Oh, yeah. And the magnitude of this, I don't know how many people are well aware of it, right? Because you've got the ISS and other satellites that have to actually do these dodge maneuvers every few months, up to a couple of times a year, just to stay out of the way of some of these unguided pieces of shrapnel. And they do sometimes, the smaller ones that you can't track, did run into the shuttle and do run into the ISS. You have these little craters that have been created by little flecks of paint, small things mm-hmm. that have intersected those vehicles.
So it's a huge problem. I'm not sure if this Kessler syndrome we've been talking about has ever happened, though. So this is this idea that was...
No.
No, okay, good. It was developed in 1978 by a NASA scientist named Donald Kessler, and he thought there are enough things in low Earth orbit that a collision between different objects could have this cascade effect, which they depicted here, with debris from the first crash causing more debris, which crashes into more stuff, and then you'd have this just lethal bombardment of shrapnel moving towards you. So it is a real thing. I don't think it's ever happened, but it is a cool premise to start a movie with, and it has some basis in reality.
And it's just a question of when you get enough stuff on orbit and enough pieces of things, right? Because eventually you could create a cloud of debris that continues to expand outward. And the fear with this is that it basically denies access to space for a certain period of time.
Right. Well, that's why people were so upset about this Chinese test, right? They really mucked up the waters there and made it much more difficult for people to operate in low Earth orbit, which is where the vast majority of spacecraft orbit. So it's just causing problems for all sorts of satellites, not just the International Space Station and other space stations.
I just want to emphasize the point you made that as you go up in orbit in terms of altitude, the residence time goes up quite a bit. I mean, one of the things that people mm-hmm. I know are very concerned about Starlink and the number of satellites that are sent up there.
Right.
But they're in such low orbits that SpaceX actually has to replace them every few years because they deorbit and they burn up.
Yeah, well, that's another problem.
Oh,
there was a very famous example from a couple of years ago where some farmers in Saskatchewan found a piece of I think it was a Starlink, and nobody knew what to do with it. And eventually, like, two dudes from SpaceX drove up in a U-Haul and picked it up and brought it back. Because there's, like, laws about this stuff, right? It doesn't belong to the farmer. It doesn't even belong to Canada. It belongs to SpaceX and the U.S. And so somebody needs to dispose of it. You can't just, like, sell it on eBay, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah. Under the Outer Space Treaty, the responsibility is whoever was the launching nation, you know, not even the company.
Yeah.
And some of these stories are just really wild. With Space Lab that went down in Western Australia, you can still visit some of those pieces.
That's cool. The other thing I really liked about this movie was the premise, in addition to the Kessler syndrome, the idea that they would be visiting the Hubble Space Telescope and repairing it was also a pretty believable premise. And I thought they depicted that pretty well. So Hubble was first launched in 1990 by a space shuttle, actually, STS-31. But it was noticed almost right away that there was a problem with its mirror. And so the fact that they could repair it was great because they could actually replace the mirror. That happened 3 years later in 1993. And then over the years, they just kept kind of upgrading it. They would replace failed instruments and replace them with new ones. I think at one point the gyroscope failed and they were able to replace that. So they were able to keep it in good working order. So it's lived many, many years past its original lifetime. I mean, it's still up and running these 36 years later, right? So they definitely did do on-orbit servicing of the Hubble, which is pretty unusual for a spacecraft. And from what I've heard, the astronauts said that the depiction of this was pretty realistic. NASA astronaut Michael Massimino, who took part in two of these servicing missions, said that nothing was out of place, nothing was missing. There was a one-of-a-kind wire cutter we used on one of my spacewalks, and sure enough, they had that wire cutter in the movie. So, you know, this is something that has happened, and it seemed pretty realistic.
Oh, yeah, and I loved all of the little specialized tools, you know, that looked just so weird. And these are so that they can be actually used by these astronauts who are in these pressure suits, don't have a lot of dexterity. And so they have these really interesting things. And you see that at several different junctures in the movie, these very specialized tools. Now, at the same time, these things do get away and create more space debris, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
So very early, you know, there's a scene where Sandra Bullock loses a bolt and George Clooney goes and grabs it. And we're like, oh, phew, thank goodness that, you know, that didn't get away. But there have been hundreds of bolts and washers and things like that that have floated away. And I believe there's been 8 different cases of larger items, like entire toolboxes that have floated away. In space. So there is some of this kind of debris creation as well.
Yeah. Yeah, everything looked about right. The shuttle looked about right. The Hubble looked about right. The International Space Station looked about right. Even the Soyuz module and I know we talked about the spacesuits being a little bit goofy, but, you know, broad strokes, they looked correct. So it didn't take me out of the movie. Everything looked good. We'll talk about this later, but most of this is CGI, so they could kind of make it look like whatever they wanted. So, but they paid attention to some of those details.
Oh yeah, like even things that experts like us would realize, like the spherical fire was great. Although Sandra Bullock forgets that having a fire extinguisher is a reaction vessel and knocks herself out briefly.
Yeah, I thought that was cute too. Like, because on Earth you'd use a fire extinguisher, and you just blast it off. But in space, if you blast a fire extinguisher, you know, every action has an equal and opposite reaction and ends up knocking herself out on a bulkhead, which would not happen on Earth. So yeah, I did. There actually have been experiments on the International Space Station where they looked at fire. You'd think, whoa, why would they do that? Because like fire is just about the worst thing that can happen in space. But they want to understand it. They want to understand how to make the space station safer. They want to understand how to make fire retardant objects on Earth safer. And so they can use space to understand that better. But unlike Earth, where you have gravity pulling in colder, denser air in to replace the hot air that the flame is making that characteristic teardrop shape. There's no gravity in space, so the flames just look spherical, which they demonstrated in this movie.
It is interesting, right? Because it's the way that the fresh oxidizer and fuel gets fed into these little spheres, which is really fascinating. And you mentioned mirror in your notes. And I remember reading Dragonfly when I was a kid about the disaster on Mir. And it's one of these things, like anytime you're in an isolated place, I mean, fire is dangerous in many contexts, but it makes me think of, you know, like fire is the worst thing that can happen on a boat, and being on a spaceship, it seems like it's a horrible thing as well. There's nowhere to go. There's nothing to do. You have to find some way to deal with it or you're lost.
Well, and what I hadn't appreciated is that a fire extinguisher in space isn't that useful either. Yes. Because, you know, fire needs air and there's a lot of air in a fire extinguisher. So this accident that happened on Mir in 1997, and the astronauts were trying, or I guess the cosmonauts were trying to put out this flame, but what eventually doused the flame was just the oxygen generator, which was fueling the fire, just emptied. So they just kind of had to wait it out. And then the space station was able to kind of filter out the smoke and clear it out so they could live there again. But what a terrifying thing to happen in space.
Oh, goodness. I mean, whenever you run into this in science fiction, I feel that's not trying to be realistic. They always just invent the compartment. And that's effective, but it doesn't really work for the kinds of systems we have on orbit right now.
No, sadly not. The other space station that was featured in this movie was Tiangong, which a lot of people probably doesn't know exists, but it's a space station that the Chinese have put up. So everyone knows the International Space Station, but the Chinese have actually put up several space stations, the first being Tiangong 1, which was launched in 2011. So it would have been up in orbit in 2013 when they were blasting around there. My only minor quibble is that it is too big in the movie. The first space station was only about 10 meters long and really consisted just of one module. You could see, like, she had to, like, turn corners and go to different modules. One of them looked like an entire rice paddy in the middle of space. The original Tiangong was not that complicated. But it is a real station. They do use the Shenzhou rocket, which is based on the Russian Soyuz module. So that was all reasonable. One fun fact, Tiangong in Chinese actually means Heavenly Palace, which is a wonderful name, I think, for a space station.
Oh, indeed. So aside from that, I think we had some different reactions to the Soyuz, but I think you have the right one there because you looked it up at what happens if a Soyuz, which typically lands on land, lands on water instead.
Yeah, well, I read this really nice article. It was online. It was, they basically asked an astronaut what he thought of gravity. He gave these nice detailed answers. The Soyuz and the Shenzhou are supposed to land on land, but they're capable of landing in water. The American vessels typically land in water, so that's the difference there. But yeah, they should have inflatable rafts and things that would inflate on contact with water and prevent it from sinking or filling up with water. And indeed, the hatch, I think they had on the wrong place on this spacecraft too, wouldn't have been that low down. They show it like basically eyeline with Sandra Bullock when she's sitting down. It would have been higher up on the spacecraft. Still, flooding of spacecraft has happened before. Famously, Gus Grissom nearly drowned on his first trip into space in 1961. Nobody knows exactly what happened because the Liberty Bell sank after this happened. That was a spacecraft, but the hatch blew open as they were trying to retrieve it from the ocean, and it started flooding with water. Gus Grissom popped out, but his spacesuit wasn't airtight either. You know, he had his helmet off and there was an open oxygen valve. And so he started sinking then too. And eventually they just gave up on the spacecraft and thankfully plucked him from the water and got him home. But this has definitely happened before. And it seems like a really terrifying scenario. Fortunately, the spacesuits in this were not realistic. So Sandra Bullock could kind of untether herself underwater and swim to the surface. Because yeah, like a flooded spacesuit, these are hundreds of pounds. Like you're not going to swim to the surface with a spacesuit on. So anyways, largely realistic with a little bit of quibbles there.
Yeah, she was really lucky to land in Lake Havasu, I have to say. You know, not too deep.
No, Lake Powell.
Oh, it wasn't? Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right.
It looked like a very CGI-heavy Lake Powell. Didn't look like the desert to me.
Well, fortunately, she didn't have it quite as bad as Gus Grissom, though. Who knows? Maybe we'll learn more about this someday when Jeff Bezos goes to, you know, dredge this up from the bottom of the ocean.
Oh, no, actually, they did recover Liberty Bell in 1999.
I did not know that.
I mean, it was pretty waterlogged by then. You can see like muscles and things stuck to the side of this spaceship, which is pretty fun.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to chat about before we go on to the Of Its Time section?
Yes. So George Clooney is constantly referring to breaking the record for like the length of the spacewalk. And he keeps talking about Anatoly, like their best buds. But this is a real person who actually does hold the record for the number of spacewalks performed and the accumulated time spent spacewalking. So he wasn't trying to break the record for a single spacewalk. As of the end of 2014, that's jointly held by Susan Helms and James Voss, and that was almost 9 hours long. He's trying to break the cumulative spacewalk record, which is held by Anatoly Soloviev, which is about 80 hours total. And this was accumulated by Anatoly between 1990 and 1998 on 16 different EVAs. It was cool to hear this referenced. He was a little too obsessed with it, I think. But it is a real record, and they did talk about a real person, so that was nice.
Yeah, I wonder, it's macabre, but I wonder if George Clooney's character actually did break it. How do you count it, you know, if you're, you know, essentially being buried in space?
Right. Like, does the record end when you die, or does it go on forever? Who's to say? The other thing, sorry, I know you wanted to keep me on topic here, John, but was the mission itself was called STS-157. They bring this up several times. And STS was the acronym they used for shuttle missions. It means Space Transportation System. So every shuttle mission has an STS number associated with it. And the last shuttle mission was actually STS-135. That was the shuttle Atlantis, which launched on July 8th, 2011. So this was 2 years before the movie came out. So what I'm imagining in this fictitious universe, they never stop launching shuttles. And so STS-151 is just some mission they had 2 years in the future. Maybe they renamed one of the shuttles for some reason, and that's why it's called Explorer. So, you know, I thought that was reasonable, although having 22 missions in 2 years is actually pretty high cadence for shuttle missions. The most frequent cadence I could find was in the 2 years leading up to the Challenger disaster. They had 16 missions, but typically less than 10 a year, but not unreasonable.
Yeah. They don't specify the year, so it could be a little further in the future potentially.
That's true.
Taking a look at the time period of the last 22 missions. Now, granted, we have the Columbia disaster in there, but it took 9 years to do 22 launches. So potentially you could think of this as far out as like the early 2020s, potentially at that kind of cadence. It's an unfortunate thing about the shuttle. I remember when I showed up at grad school, we had this little computing lab, you know, back in the day, and there were posters in there about the shuttle program, the early shuttle program from the late 70s and early 80s. And they talked about the cadence they were expecting and what it was going to be like. And these posters said,
right,
go into work in space. And they talked about launches as rapidly as every couple of weeks. The whole idea behind the STS was that it was going to make access to space cheaper. And it did not pan out that way. These launches ended up being really quite expensive. The whole program cost something on the order of $200 billion for 135 launches. So they ended up not being quite the democratizing of space that they had hoped to be.
Yeah, no space bus, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Still haven't figured that out.
Well, it was a space transport truck, right?
Okay, space truck, that sounds cooler.
I feel like there's been a few movies about that. Maybe we'll review them in the future, but for now, we'll move on to the Of Its Time section when we return.
Right. So this is the portion of the podcast where we talk about how this movie is situated in the years it was developed and released. So this was filmed in the summer of 2011 and then released October 4th, 2013 in the US. So we're talking over a decade ago. What did you think placed this in its time, John?
Even though we're thinking of this potentially in the near future, it was the way I was thinking of it and you were thinking of it right in its place. We see the shuttle, which we know stopped flying in 2011. We see the International Space Station. We're seeing the way that spaceflight is done right now. So it felt very present that way, I think. And the filmmakers did a really excellent job of getting a lot of the little details right and of taking the tools that they had, those CGI tools, and really, you know, making this look like it was something that was not thinking of the future, but thinking more of like the present or the very, very near future. And we sort of foreshadowed we were going to talk about the CGI here. I think there was something like around 90 shots in the film. They're very long shots in this movie. That builds attention, of course. And of those, something like 80 were CGI shots. So there's a lot going on in the background processing here. What positioned it for you?
Well, the actors are very key, right? Mm-hmm. Sandra Bullock and George Clooney were very famous actors at this point. I mean, they still are, but you just don't see them as much. So they seemed like very key actors for this time period. Apparently, they tried to get Angelina Jolie to play this role. I cannot imagine this movie with Angelina Jolie playing Ryan Stone. And then she couldn't do it because of scheduling conflicts. And then they asked Natalie Portman. She would have been okay, I think. But then I think she was pregnant, so she couldn't do it. And eventually settled on Sandra Bullock, who had actually just won an Oscar earlier that year. So it seemed like a good fit. What bothers me a little bit, again, the misogyny. This is Sandra Bullock's movie, right? She's basically the only character in it. George Clooney's only in the first 30 minutes of the movie, except for, you know, the one hallucination scene. And it's a 90-minute movie. So, you know, this is Sandra Bullock's movie. But at the very end, when they list the actors, they get equal billing. And I did not like that, I gotta say.
It's probably the marketing department, right? Trying to sell the thing with whoever they feel has the most star power. And there was another point that the director made in here, Cuarón, who was talking about the trailers. So there's a lot of times there's a lot of times in this movie when there's silence. So we were thinking, oh, you know, that's a nice foreshadowing off to something like For All Mankind that uses that silence really effectively. And it really lets you know that it is Sandra Bullock's movie. Like when she knocks herself out, the sound goes away because it's her perspective.
Right.
But in the trailers, the studio added back the sound to make it more kinetic, to make it more exciting. And yeah, they made sure that did not make its way into the film.
No, I guess there's actually a whole cut of this movie where they even got rid of the score. They got rid of the music. So it's just like the silent version of this film, which would be pretty cool to see, I think. Immerse yourself in space. Although, again, talking about that article I read by the astronaut who was giving his thoughts on this film, he said space isn't actually that quiet because you always have like the constant hum of the motors in your spacesuit, the chatter on the radio, and actually having a silent spacesuit would be quite scary because you know something's gone very wrong.
Yeah, there's a few movies that use that effect to heighten the tension, you know, that suddenly it's too quiet.
Too quiet. Yes, exactly. I also love that they had Ed Harris playing the voice of Mission Control because he will forever be Gene Kranz to me from Apollo 13. You can barely tell it's him. I only figured it out because I saw the cast list online. But that was a kind of a fun callback to a very popular space movie from the 90s.
Very, very inspired, though. I feel for Ed Harris that he got demoted from flight director to Capcom.
Well, at least he doesn't have to work with James Cameron, though, right? A little Abyss callback there. It is unusual for the character herself to have a name of Ryan. That was called out by George Clooney. So this is a bit of its time. I do know several women and girls with that name, but it is true. It would have been extremely rare for her generation. I looked it up. So the Social Security Agency actually lists, because they get all like the baby names of everyone in the US. And so you can look up like how popular your name was year on year. And Ryan, as a girl's name, only cracked the top 1,000 in 1974. Sandra Bullock was born in 1964. And the year it was most popular was 1986, but it was only like 0.04% of the total girl births. So it is an unusual name, and that was true. Perhaps slightly less unusual now than it was, but I thought that was kind of a fun thing to look up.
I do feel, and maybe you've got a better impression of this than I do, Catherine. I do feel like back when we were young, there were a few names that were very popular and that parents wanted their kids to fit in. And now there's this desire for uniqueness that leads to just a huge panoply of different names.
Yeah, so I was expecting Ryan to get more popular with time, but it kind of peaked there in the 80s, and then there was maybe another little peak in the 2010s, maybe because of this movie, who knows?
Could be.
But right now, it's 715th most popular, so it's not really that popular right now either. So these things come in waves, I would say. But you're right, all the kids have unusual names these days for the most part.
Well, something that we can't avoid in thinking about this one is just how impactful it was at the time. Like, we think about science fiction, and those of us who've been around long enough, we think of this as it's a genre movie, right? But here's the crazy thing. This is the most awarded movie by the Oscars for the entire 2010s decade. It is the biggest movie that Sandra Bullock or George Clooney have been in. Like, this is their highest grossing property.
Yeah, I was surprised to learn that.
We talked about it with The Martian, right? Like, that's Ridley Scott's biggest film too.
I know. Hard to believe. Yeah, and it's one of the few movies that have won like 7 Academy Awards, but not Best Picture. I think Cabaret in 1972 was the other one that has that notability. So they like the movie, but just not well enough to give it the Best Picture award.
Well, it got Best Director, which, you know, sometimes is,
yes,
you know,
that's pretty good.
Yeah. And often, like, the Best Director, it's like, you know, this is the one that we wanted to give, but the other people were due or something like that.
Yeah. It also led to one of the best quotes from the 2014 Golden Globes, in which a host, Tina Fey, said, "Gravity is nominated for Best Film. It's the story of how George Clooney would rather float away into space and die rather than spend one more minute with a woman his own age." George Clooney famously is married to somebody 17 years his junior. So anyways, I thought that was a fun little quote there. They did not win, I think, that award either.
Well, speaking of expressions of youth in these kinds of videos, you brought up this interesting parallel with Aliens. There's a point where you've got Sandra Bullock, who is just taking a minute after getting out of the spacesuit and is just floating there in the fetal position with some hoses, you know, artfully placed. And that mirrors what we saw with Alien as well, but we haven't done Alien yet. I'm sure we'll get to that one. And
oof,
it's an image.
That's a scary one.
Oh, yeah. Well, these are images that keep coming up. Like, we ran into it at the end of 2001 as
that's
well.
True.
Something with, you know, like, space and gestation seems to go together.
Yeah, although watching this with my nurse husband, he said that is not how somebody in shock, how they would react after such a stressful situation. You're not just going to curl up in the fetal position and take a nap. But yeah, clearly it's a theme the director wanted to explore. The final scene at the end where she lands and crawls out of the water onto this weirdly CGI'd version of Lake Powell, he said, "She's in these murky waters almost like an amniotic fluid or a primordial soup. Crawls out of the water, not unlike early creatures in evolution. And then she goes on all fours. And after going on all fours, she's a bit curved until she's completely erect. It was the evolution of life in one quick shot." So, I mean, this is not really a movie about space. The director's always said it's a movie about adversity, and he just used space as the backdrop. So there's a lot of artistry in here that just uses space as the stage. But, you know, I appreciate the director's vision here.
Yeah, he's very eclectic in terms of the subjects that he takes on. It's hard to pin him down. So, I mean, not only do we have this big technological sci-fi epic, but we have the much smaller Children of Men also in science fiction, but The Prisoner of Azkaban in the Harry Potter universe, and I can never pronounce this one, like, it's Itu Mama Tambien, which is a very art house kind of film.
Yes, I did. I don't know. I like this director. I didn't know much about him before watching this movie, but he has eclectic taste. He clearly has a vision for this movie. And I watched all the credits all the way to the end. I guess I'm in my Marvel mode where there's always like, you know, an end credit scene. I wanted to stick around. And at the very end, I noticed a mi mama, gracias. He wrote it in the credits. He was thanking his mother, dedicating this to his mother, which I thought was very sweet. So I like this guy.
That is very kind. Speaking of all the way to the end of the credits type of thing, even though this is technically uncredited, there was a good set of science advisors working on this one, one of whom is quite famous. He comes up on Wikipedia as a planetary scientist, Kevin Grazier, who's been involved with 27 different films and TV shows, including one of your favorites, Catherine, Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, I've never heard of this guy. Apparently he worked on Cassini too, but we clearly never overlapped.
Yeah, somebody maybe with the ISS team, since there's a picture of him with the Carolyn Porco, who are recreating the Abbey Road image.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I didn't interact with the ISS team. That's the Imaging Science Subsystem, not the International Space Station.
Very confusing.
On Cassini. It is very confusing. That would make sense. I was on the Cassini radar team, and the instruments didn't really talk to each other as much as perhaps we should have. So...
Well, something else that I got a strong feeling of watching this movie was the comments that William Shatner, the original Captain Kirk, made after his suborbital voyage with Blue Origin. And we talked in previous reviews about the overview effect, the idea that you go up and you see the world as one and you're filled with this wonderful warm sensation. And that was not how Shatner saw it. So he actually saw something very, very different. Like he, if just to read the quote here, he said that, "I love the mystery of the universe. I love all the questions that have come to us over thousands of years of exploration and hypotheses. But when I looked in the opposite direction, space, there was no mystery, no majestic awe to behold. And all I saw was death." So you get this sense that space is an unforgiving, unkind, unconductive place to the kinds of processes that we have, you know, here on Earth that make life possible, that make this a warm and comforting place to be. And I don't know, I felt that strongly in watching the movie.
Well, yeah, and it was clearly the director's vision too. The opening scene has like this list of text describing how awful the temperatures are in space. There's nothing to carry sound, no air pressure, no oxygen. And it ends with, "Life in space is impossible." So clearly that's what he was going for as well. And if Ryan Stone was a real person, I'm pretty sure she'd never go back to space after this experience. So yeah, it's a part of space travel you don't hear a lot about. Right? Everyone just is like, "Oh, it's so exciting." It's like the character Sharif, who's kind of like bouncing around. Clooney's like, "Oh, you'd never know he had a degree from Harvard," because he's just having a good time in space. That's, I think, the picture you get of space. But I think the director and William Shatner here have some good points. Like, I never want to go into space. And this is primarily why. Like, the Earth is great. I love the sky. I love the air. I love the plants. I love the water. It's a great place to be.
Indeed. Well, what do you think? Shall we go on to the ratings?
We shall. All right, this is the portion of the podcast where we rate the movie. We rate it on a scale of 1 to 5 in 3 categories, starting with scientific accuracy, then moving on to influence, and how does it hold up? So, John, what did you give this for scientific accuracy?
So I think I have been converted a little bit by the discussion that we've had here, but I think that what's interesting to me is that all of the scientific inaccuracies that we've run into are all kind of beneath the surface. You have to look at the film more closely. And this is a film that is more meant to be experienced. So all the little things that might take you out of the film, those are all perfect. So I decided to give this one a 4.5, even though, you know, there are some in the background fairly significant things.
Yeah, I gave it a 3.5 because those significant things, I think, are pretty significant. You know, the whole fact that there's no way this would even happen, right? Because all the different orbits are wrong and you can't actually get hit from debris from another orbit and then transfer to a different space station on a different orbit. I mean, the premise is just wrong. But I didn't find it distracting. And to me, that's the death knell of a movie, right? If the science is so bad, it's distracting me and I'm like yelling at the screen, that's not good. That didn't happen here. It was a very immersive experience. It was good enough to be believable. So I'll give it a 3.5. How about its influence? How did you rate it there?
Yeah, so this is interesting, right? Like it's hard to give a low rating to something that was so successful at the box office that won so many awards. I mean, you go into the IMDb page, it's not, we talk about the 7 Oscars, but there's like 240 awards that this thing racked up. It clearly made a huge impression at the time. These days, it is a little less well known. I wasn't able to find it on any streaming service. I had to go ahead and rent a copy of it. I'm conflicted here. So I went with a 4 in this case, which maybe is a little bit aspirational, but it definitely, it's hard to say because we had the same conversation with The Martian, right? Like how much influence can we expect a movie to have these days? Is there a movie that's 10 or 15 years old that we do still talk about?
But there are movies that are 50 years old that we still talk about.
Oh, we talk about movies. Like, it seems like there's a gap, you know? It's weird, right? Like, it's hard to pick of movies that we still talk about in the last 10, 15, 20 years. But there are so many that are older than that. So there's something weird happening in culture, I think.
We're just not making good movies anymore?
Maybe what a movie is
just people
different.
Have stopped watching?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. You're right. It is weird. Like, I can think of so many movies from the 70s, 80s, 90s that have stuck around and people still talk about. I still watch them with my children. Like, Star Wars just turned 49,
yeah.
Right? Like, it's huge. It's still huge. But you're right. Anything from 2010 onward is kind of lost in the sauce, and I'm not sure why. Maybe there's just too many distractions these days, and so it's not as much of a cultural phenomenon for everyone to go see the same movie.
Maybe it's similar to what happens with music, right? In the sense that back in the day, you were competing with whatever else was out in the multiplex at the time. Now you're competing with every movie that has ever been made.
Right, right. And YouTube, yeah, and, yeah. You know, whatever, and TikTok, and whatever anyone can come up with on their own. So, yeah. So I gave it a 2. I agree with John. It was really big at the time. I mean, in 2013, I would have given this a 4, 4.5, right? It was very... It was a big deal, like such a big deal that I went out and found a babysitter to, you know, look after my 4-month-old for the first time because I wanted to see it. But when John brought it up, I was like, oh yeah, I forgot about that movie. I hadn't thought about it in years or heard about it in years. So despite being very big at the time, it just no one talks about it anymore. And so I couldn't give it a very high score for influence. All right. Lastly, how does it hold up, John? What do you think?
I was worried about this because we are talking about something now that is 13 years old, but at least, you know, on my iPad screen, not on my IMAX theater, which I do not have, it looks amazing. It could have been made yesterday. Like, this has been put together with such care and such attention to detail, which is really amazing because you've got so many one shots and so many wonders. And that's a bold choice for a director to take. It pays off, and it still pays off today. So 4.5.
I also gave it a 4.5. It looks really good. I mean, this movie is like, the majority of it is CGI. They actually came up with a really innovative way of filming the characters. They put them in like a light box and just filmed their head and then edited that into the CGI. But unless you're looking really closely, it's all seamless. You don't notice it. It looks like you're in space. And this is like the type of movie you couldn't have made even 5-10 years before 2013. I think the director was interested in making a movie like this, but the technology hadn't really caught up to him. But by 2013, it was good enough that he was able to make this movie, and it still looks good to this day.
And it's really wonderful, I think, the idea that the technology is in service to the vision of the director rather than
right.
some kind of toy that's being used just to make something try to look pretty. Those don't tend to hold up. These ones do. So, yeah.
Yeah. We'll see how it looks another 10 years. But for now, I was still pretty engrossed by it.
Well, anything else you want to bring up, Catherine, before we end?
I think that'll do it. How do you want to carry us out here, John?
Well, thanks everyone for listening this week, and we look forward to talking to you again next week. But until then, I hate space. Popcorn Science is hosted by Catherine Niche and John Moores, with Catherine taking the lead on pre-production, sourcing clips, and writing show notes, and John taking the lead on post-production and sound editing. Artwork for the show is provided by science illustrator Michelle Parsons, while Sean Nock handles web hosting and ensures that our conversations make their way to your favorite podcasting service.